Well, I guess we're getting in the last lap, huh? When Lou asked me to speak, I had been asked to speak at the University of Vienna, and they wanted to speak to me for 6 hours a day for 3 days, each day. And I said, I can't speak 6 hours a day for 3 days. By the time the third day comes around, I'll be able to talk.
Well,
so
you're going to, in a little while, you're
going to
go escape back to those cool temperatures in Canada, huh?
Yeah, sure. I'm not a great one for, see, we don't have air conditioning where we are, so this is all kind of, I'm not real comfortable with air conditioning, but I know that's.
What town, Professor Adams?
What town?
Yes.
I live in a town called Omimi. Omimi. Yeah.
Whereabouts?
It's near Lindsay.
Oh, okay.
Near Lindsay, yeah. It's a little Indian name to it. Was once a bustling little town. Once had 7 hotels and 5 gas stations. Now it has no gas station, no hotels. It has a Max Milk. That's about it. Things went around it, and it, you know, it's kind of disappeared like that happens sometimes.
Is it
yeah.
Ontario, is
that? Yeah, it's in Ontario. Yeah, but
is that near Ottawa or Toronto?
Well, it's near Toronto, about 80 miles from Toronto. It's out in the country, and beautiful country. I really love it up there.
Yeah,
rolling hills and things like that. Yes, it's great. It's a beautiful place. I really enjoy it. Being a California boy, I even found the winters interesting, you know, because most people live up in that area, you know, what we call snowbirds and the name for them. But my wife is a homebody, and so she gets homesick when I get to the front gate, so we don't do good going south. But since it's the last session, and since maybe you'd like to talk about some creative things, I have a chapter in my book about suggestions for reforming the tax system. And there's one about how a good tax goes bad. That's kind of a cute chapter. It has some interesting observations. It's based on the assumption that somebody 200 years in the future were to look back at our tax system, how would they see it? Because, you know, we look back at the British system and the Spanish, and we see what we didn't like about them or do like. So what would they see? Well, I thought I could hold that. Go into my suggestions for what we could do. I also have a list of about 27 suggestions on learning from the past. But I have one chapter called Taming the Monster, meaning the tax system. And some people have picked up on this and thought it was quite interesting. So I'll just throw them out, and you can say what you think of them.
What page?
That's on page 460 of the new edition. 457, yeah. And the first item I say is to tear down the spy system. Remember we talked about how it was an honor system, now it's a spy system. I think we should tear down the spy system. I think that has simply destroyed our liberties probably more than anything else. And if you'll remember, Montesquieu said that freedom and liberty as the seeds of its own destruction, because you give the revenue authorities too much authority, then they have to have too much power, and once they have too much power, you've lost your liberties. And we've already lost them all. I mean, I think our spy system is just outrageous, that every time we turn around that we have to file a form or we're being watched or photographing our bank accounts. I think this is outrageous for a free society. I don't think you can call yourself a free society with all the intrusions that we live with. And now, of course, with the Patriot Act, I suppose there's probably nothing left. It's really too bad. So my first idea would be to tear down the spy system. Can anybody say why we shouldn't? You all like it? Yeah.
All my peers, not all of them, but practically all of them here, it's a university town, they're retired,
yeah,
are delighted with the system.
Just like Clinton. Just like Clinton, right? Bill Clinton.
Oh, mercy.
Yeah.
My wife had a terrible morning with a friend who just, what a wonderful convention they had, and what a tremendous Kerry is, and what a wonderful speech Clinton made. She had a hard time keeping her mouth shut, which she did, which is a good thing, because she's not very...
Well, that's why...
Have you got an answer?
That's why we have a spy system, because we tolerate it.
What's the answer to these devoted worshipers of Washington?
I don't know. You can just ask them what becomes of our liberty if you photograph everything in our bank account. What becomes of our liberty if every time we turn around we have to file an information return? What becomes of our liberty if the government knows everything we're doing? In fact, some writers years ago says the test of liberty is how much the government does not know about you.
Yes. Today they're going to argue that we need all that because otherwise terrorists are going to use financial systems.
Well, but we had the spy system before 9/11. I mean, they just added a little inchy weensy bit of muscle. They got so much now. What can they do? So every time you turn around, that you have to file an information return. They know what you're doing.
Well, these people like his friends that he's talking about, they think it's your duty to pay taxes, a certain amount of taxes to support the government so it can carry on all the wonderful work it does, and that anybody who doesn't do that is a villain. And also,
well, they're on the payroll.
Yeah, they're on, yeah, some of them, that's true. I mean, they are. But they think that if they'll turn people in, or I'm not saying his friends will turn people in, but many people will turn people in if they're not paying, if they think they're trying to avoid taxes, because I think, well, that drives up everybody else's taxes, which is not necessary.
Well, you know, that is not. I know I hear that argument. I say, wait a minute.
It's not true.
You have nothing to do with your taxes, and if the government comes up short, maybe that's a good thing. They'd have less money to spend. You know, that's always been my argument. Now, in the ancient times, it was true that the taxes were on a town. And if somebody left town, like did in the Roman days, then the bill fell back on the rest of them. Well, we don't have that problem. So when they say if you don't pay it, then somebody else says, oh no, the less money they have, the better off we are.
Well, that worries. The government has to raise taxes and to get the money, that, you know, higher percentage from everybody else, because they're not getting it from you and him who's cheating or whatever. But there's only so much that's going to be tolerated on tax rates, so it won't go up.
They don't raise the rates based on the fact that somebody cheats. No, that's true. But I think that the first thing we should do is tear down the spy system. And it reminds me of Ronald Reagan when he was in Berlin and he says, Gorbachev, tear this wall down. And I think that should apply to our taxes. I particularly, because I grew up at a time when we didn't have the spy system. And they just keep adding to it and adding to it every year. They put one more thing. So that's the first thing I think we should think about doing, is tearing down the spy system.
The only way you can cut costs is to eliminate programs. And there's no program that somebody doesn't profit.
Sure, it's why they're there. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Well, the second thing I suggest.
As our historian, can you give us examples as we think politically about circumstances that are necessary to successfully reduce the taxes, owners, tax regimes? Are there any examples where societies have reformed themselves without pulling out the guillotines?
Well, the guillotine was really a good solution.
Well, isn't the Soviet Union?
Yeah, the American Revolution was a protest against taxes. They didn't like the stamp tax, and they revolted and got rid of that. They didn't like the custom taxes, and they got rid of that. And then when we reformed and Hamilton and his bunch said we'll need more money, we'll tax whiskey, they revolted and got rid of that. So America has a wonderful history of revolting against taxes and getting rid of them. And we even had a lot of resistance against the income tax after the Civil War, and we got rid of that too, you'll see. So it certainly is possible. But I think that we fall back on Gladstone's observation that the real culprit is the public expenditure. And if we didn't have the public expenditure, then we wouldn't need the taxes. Yeah.
I'm going to give you a tough one for you to answer.
Okay.
I think
last year in
the state of Alabama, we voted down a money bill. The governor stated he needed $1.3 billion mm-hmm. extra revenue. He was $700,000 short, so he needed $1.3 billion, which sounds like government accounting. Whatever, we voted it down, which I thought was a clear message.
Yeah.
You guys are spending too much, be more careful. You don't know this campus, but if you care to try, you can't even walk around this campus with the number of buildings that are being torn down and re-erected this year.
Yeah, I know that.
And you didn't give them the money.
I did walk around.
It's a little bit crowded. You can't drive through.
Sure, that wasn't in the pipeline a long time ago?
Oh, I'm sure it was, but it certainly did. They didn't care what we voted.
Yeah.
It was in the, there's a justification for it.
Yeah, well, that was sort of like Teddy Roosevelt when he asked for money to send the American fleet around the world, and Congress turned him down, and so he sent it anyway. They got halfway around the world, they ran out of money, they ran out of fuel, so Congress had to had to bail them out money to bring the fleet home. Otherwise, they'd been stuck on India someplace. Now, your politicians can really be difficult animals when it comes to money, but I still think that we cannot tolerate a spy system and be a free society. We just can't do that. Now, if the income tax requires this kind of a spy system to work, which it didn't for 50 years, so it isn't like then we're going to have a different tax system. It's just that simple. We can't afford the loss of our liberties just to collect taxes. We can just get a better system that doesn't require it. So that was my first point. My second point was we should establish a crime for tax extortion, just like the Romans did, as well as a civil action for damages. What that means is if a revenue agent comes in, he audits you, and he tries to stick it to you, and he doesn't have a basis to do it, we can sue the son of a bitch, and we can throw him in jail.
This
in my book, yeah. And I've had people pick up on that because revenue agents have a wonderful habit of shaking you down. Mm-hmm. I remember where agents went into one of my clients, and it was a big company, and the guy came in and spent a day looking through the books. And he said, well, it's interesting. He says, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll wrap the audit up now for $1 million because I think I can find it. Well, he couldn't. But you see, that was a shakedown. That was extortion. And I don't think they should be able to do that. And they do that.
What they're doing is tobacco companies.
They do it all the time. It's not anything new. But that
was, it's cheaper to pay than it is to fight.
Yes.
Yeah. It is cheaper
to pay. You missed the son of a bitch here.
Huh? Well, we just need a more courageous people. People that do fight, and a lot of them do. A lot of them put up with it. I thought that was a good idea, and it was based on Roman law. Because the Romans, this is Roman law. And they provided, in the early days, if the tax man collected more than he was entitled to, they would crucify him on the spot. Bring out the cross and hang the guy up and get the message out there. So I think it's a legitimate I think it's legitimate that if an agent tries to shake you down, you ought to be able to sue the guy, and he ought to be liable in criminal matters. He has an obligation to enforce the tax law honestly and fairly and justly. And if he tries to shake it down like they did my client, the guy says, I'll take $1 million and end the audit today. Well, that is absolute extortion. Had no business doing that. So anyway, then I got my third thing, establish a civil action for damages for tortious tax administration, including malicious tax investigations, extortions, leaked information, and grand jury abuse. You know, they go to the grand jury. If you know how the grand jury works, you know, the only people there is prosecutor. And a lot of them will say, well, you know, they'll introduce a little bit of evidence if they indict the guy and so forth. I don't, if they have these weak cases, they go grand jury, I think they ought to answer to it. If they can't come up with a solid case, I think somebody ought to go to jail or ought to be sued for damages, because that's a terrible burden on people to have to defend themselves against the charge. And then they try to shake you down. Then they say, well, we'll make a plea bargain. And the plea bargain means that you won't get quite as many years in jail as if you got convicted, but sometimes they don't have a case anyway. And so they fall back on plea bargain to get off from under it. So I think we need to go after these guys. I feel very strongly about that. And I think that grand jury abuse is one that really bothers me, because the theory of grand jury was to protect you from groundless prosecutions. And it so happens that the prosecuting attorneys go in there and they make up their little case, and a lot of grand juries just tell them what to do. And I think that we need protection from that kind of stuff. Okay, my fourth point, this is one I thought was really good. Have all federal tax districts correspond with congressional districts? So the district director of Internal Revenue for your district would be the same district that your congressman is in. And that gives your congressman an obligation to keep his thumb on this guy from misbehaving. And you see, that isn't what happened in my case that I told you about the other day. The member of the House, representatives, contacted the district director in Los Angeles, and the district director told him, please be go to hell. Because his district is up here in Ventura, and the district director for Los Angeles covered a number of congressional districts. I would have each congressional district have its own district director of Internal Revenue. And I think that would help those guys to behave a little bit. They wouldn't be telling congressmen where they could go. So these are well thought out. I thought from my experience, these made good sense. Then I thought that tax disputes should be adjudicated like any other debt. The idea of having to pay the tax and sue to get it back is pretty ridiculous, but that's the way the system worked. And otherwise, you have to go to tax court, and tax court was originally just an administrative court. It was called the Board of Tax Appeals or some dumb name. And so they eventually called it the tax court, and that's the only way you can get adjudication without paying for it. I think you should be able to adjudicate your tax obligation just like you adjudicate any debt. Somebody says you owe money, then you say sue me. And the IRS says you owe you money, I would say sue me. And then we go to court, and we'd have right to jury trial. We'd have all the benefits that we're supposed to have in civil litigation. So I think that would be a good point. I'd like to see that in there. Then I thought we should decriminalize the tax law. You remember I quoted all those famous guys like Adam Smith and Montesquieu and how they said that a tax evasion should not be a crime.
So you're proposing that it be civil only?
Civil only.
So you're yeah. subject to fines.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you might want to go maybe to where the Swiss are. The Swiss have a crime of tax fraud, but it has to be a real fraud. See, we use the word tax fraud and you didn't file a tax return. Well, that's no tax fraud. And what tax fraud is, it would be a simple example. Is suppose you buy yourself a yacht and you put it on your business as a bulldozer. You start depreciating. That's tax fraud, you see. And okay, I would grant legitimate common law fraud. Okay, if it's legitimate. But I certainly don't think that you can call a tax evasion, not filing a tax return, as a crime. If I don't pay my gas bill, it's not a crime. They have to come after me. And I think if you don't pay your tax bill, they should have to come after you, civil action. And then you have all the protection, the benefits that the law provides for a civil lawsuit. So I'm not really that radical, but I've had a lot of positive comments about this. And this is another one. Now, my seventh one on my list is make congressional representatives and federal judges immune from the IRS. That way they wouldn't have the pressure on them and you know, what are they going to do to me? And I think that if your congressman was immune from the IRS, he could look out for your best interest. And the problem is that now he's afraid of what they'll do to him.
You mean he'd still have to pay his taxes?
No, I would make them immune from the tax system. And that would give them independent aloofness and they'd be away
well,
from
it. Well, then we need to take away in compensation, we need to eliminate their special pensions and their special health programs.
Well, whatever you want to do. I would just say get the IRS off their back so they can...
It'd be cheap.
Yeah.
Murray Rothbard argued that people who are paid by the government employees or Congress and so forth didn't pay taxes anyway. They just simply, if you're paid $100,000 and you give $30,000 back, you only receive $70,000 in income, because if they take from the tax pot to give it to you and then they put it back in the tax pot, it's the net effect is all there is.
Yeah. See, my purpose here is to make your representative in Congress free and independent.
Right.
Because we had so many examples of where they went after they went after the IRS and they ended up in real trouble. So this isn't just something I thought about on the moon. This is something that is a real case, and there's not enough tax in that bunch of guys to mount a hill of beans. And they're serving the public anyway, and they're probably underpaid considering what they do. So I don't think they should have to pay taxes because it makes them immune and they can do what's best for us.
Not underpaid in Alabama.
Hmm? I know that's funny. What was it?
Not underpaid in Alabama.
Oh, not underpaid. Well, I just like the idea because then it would make them immune and then they can do what's best for the country. And you know, the Constitution had this in mind. There's a provision in the Constitution that says the judges can have their pay diminished. I mean, maybe you're aware of it. And years ago, when the income tax came out, a number of the federal judges took it to court that they didn't have to pay income taxes because of what the Constitution said. You're diminishing our pay. And the Constitution said you can't diminish their pay. Well, of course, they didn't win, but they had a point. And at least because the idea was that they would have an aloofness from the paying process. This is their salary and nobody's going to take it away from them. And so there was even a theory on it, yes.
That does seem kind of funny that the government would tax the tax money they're giving to their employees. Like a built-in mechanism, at least. That would make any sense. Mm-hmm. Or if you were going to give your money, have to give it back.
Well, remember in history that I've talked about, in Spain, the civil service paid no tax. There's one other way you got out of the system. And you go all the way back to ancient Egypt. The scribes paid no tax. And that one teacher says, mark it well. He who works in writing is not taxed. And he was telling his kids where they should go rather than get out into the field. So,
would that apply to Carey's wife?
To his wife?
Carey's wife.
Oh, Carey's wife. Yeah, but Carrie, yeah, that's right. She does have a few bucks, doesn't she? Yeah, but I'm only talking about him. No, I'm only talking about, yeah. It's rather funny. Democratic Party produces this patrician from Boston with all the great wealth that's at his disposal, and he's a Democrat. You know, it's really strange. It's kind of illogical, because they claim to be so much concerned about the working man, and the poor hell guy never worked a day in his life, but really... Okay, that's my seventh point. I got one more point. Well, I just said make the federal tax system as indirect as possible. And they were talking about sales taxes and things of that sort and getting rid of the forms of direct taxation. Well, anyway. Yeah, this is Andrew Mellon, who maybe you don't know the whole story of Mellon. Mellon was the Secretary of Treasury during the 20s. And for some reason, Roosevelt hated him. I think Roosevelt had a problem because he was a bit of a aristocrat in origin, you know, the Roosevelt family and so forth, yet he didn't quite get accepted into the blue bloods of the East. You know, he didn't get in the right country club, but he was always kind of bitter of that. So he turns around during the night when he becomes president and has Andrew Mellon indicted for tax evasion. And he's the Secretary of Treasury for, you know, one of the richest guys in America. And it went on, and they never succeeded in it, but it was just a way of harassing him. And this would go to my point of bringing groundless tax suits and being liable for damages for doing it, whoever brought that case. Yeah, and you remember Ella Ehrlichman, who used the IRS, he called in the IRS to go after Nixon's enemies, and using these exact words, he says, "I hate your goddamn foot dragging. You know, go after these guys." Well, the worst thing in the world is for the executive to have the power to use the tax system to punish people. And if they do it, they should get punished. One of our problems is we tolerate too much misdeeds from our government, and particularly our police and things like that. I don't know why, well, we do tolerate it. I mean,
we know it happens, and it's as vile a crime as you can imagine, almost.
Yeah.
Remember, Kennedy used that to force the steel executives to accept a union contract. Yeah.
He also went after the Protestants who complained about his being a Catholic, too, and he turned the IRS on that. But see, they get away with it. The reason we have the problem is because they can do it and with impunity, with immunity. They don't have anything to fear. And it's just one of the really bad aspects of our tax system. And even our government, they can do this, you know. But maybe someday we'll learn, because other societies, the Romans particularly, the Spanish, they've had this problem, and they solved it. Who was it? Let me just...
But isn't it true that government becomes more corrupt the longer it continues?
Yeah, I think that's a truism, yeah. And I think the more power you get, what was it that power corrupts? Or no, power tends to corrupt? And absolute power corrupts absolutely. Who was it that said that?
Lord Atkin.
Yeah. Do you remember what he said about when he wrote to Robert E. Lee? He said that one of the worst, I don't know exactly how he said it, but one of the worst things that happened, he says, is when you lost the war, because I was more upset with your defeat than I was with our victory at Waterloo. I think that's exactly what he said, yeah. And he was a guy that had a great sense of, I think, of justice. But his power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. I mean, we just live with that every day. And so that would apply to that. Let me talk a little bit about George Clemenceau. He was the Prime Minister of France in World War I. And after the war was over, he came and he spoke and lectured at the Ivy universities. I used to call them Ivy universities, you know, the big university in the East. And when he was leaving on the docks of New York, the press came down to interview him and asked him how he liked his visit to America, and he said it was fine. And he said, "Do you have any complaints about the American people?" And he said, "Yeah, a couple." He says, first, he says, "You make a lousy cup of coffee." French and great. Secondly, he says, "You're terribly ignorant of history." It was his second complaint. And I think both of them is still pretty true, even though we do have some of the coffee machines are just ghastly. Anyway, so then there's on the remedies, there's a fellow who made the statement in a bar in Paris. He said, "My fortune is in the Bahamas, as long as there's that son of a bitch in the White House." Referring to Roosevelt. Well, I have a list of the very lessons from history. If Clemenceau is right, and he probably is, the very fact that we don't have a lot of interest in tax history when it's the most fundamental thing in society is amazing. But it seems to be true. I have found that in my experience. I wanted to go into the history a little bit and how a good tax system goes bad, because our income tax system, even though the rates were kind of high, wasn't too bad, but it's really gone bad. And one of the areas that's gone bad, I think, is in the criminal punishments for tax evasion. And in my book, I talk about a fellow by the name of Otto Lambden. He was Lambert. Anyway, he's the finance minister of Germany. You know, he's like Secretary of Treasury. So they charged him with evading 1.4 million Deutschmarks of taxes. And he tried, and he lost, and they punished him with a fine, and then he was reelected. And when he was consulted about the whole ordeal, he says, well, it was an inconvenience, and this is the way he described it. At the same time that this happened, that was the time that we had some interesting prosecutions. One of them, I didn't bring it with me, but one of them was a group down in the Cayman Islands that called themselves the United States Tax Planning Service. And they had this beautiful ad, had a picture of the Boston Celtics with a flag, and had a picture of USC with a flag, and at the bottom had a picture of U.S. Tax Planning Services. Well, the IRS went after those guys, and it was Mickey Mouse stuff. You know, they should have got in trouble. But when they came up to get punished, there was a judge, Dean Whipple, in Kansas City, that gave the guy 25 years. And then the other guy behind this, from which they got this team idea, you know, which is this tax planning team. You see it a lot today. Now they're using the team stuff. Have you noticed that in the markets and so forth? You know, team this, team that. We have a kind of, was a guy who was a wrestling coach up in Oregon. And he was the one that thought of the team idea. Well, they gave him 25 years in the can. And when he tried to get it reduced, they wouldn't reduce it. So here are these grotesque punishments that we hand out. And one was a lady named Trula Walker. And I thought maybe that the judge didn't like women. But she apparently cheated on $1 million worth of taxes. And she got 25 years. So what are we doing things like that for? You could rob a bank and get less punishment than that. But this is a theory. You scare the hell out of everybody. That's why some of the cartoons are kind of cute that I've dug up. And one of the old ones shows a guy up in a tree, and underneath is an IRS agent, and the guy's up in the tree looking down at him, and he says, "All I asked for was a match." or the one that shows the American terrorist is an IRS guy with a briefcase. So I think that's a pocket of tyranny that we have that's pretty sad. There's a guy who wrote a little book called The April Game. Have any of you heard of that book? It's really a delight. It's old publication. It's written by an IRS agent, and he tells his story, and he says that, let me show you what he says about, I got the right book. I got too many books, I can't keep track of them. He said that we're worse than the Gestapo. He says, of all the information gathering agency in all the world's governments, past or present, the very cleverest must surely be the United States Internal Revenue Service. That monster organization gathers more information about more people and does it quietly and raises less public outcry in the process than any other government outfit I know of. It may be that the Soviet Union and Red China can boast of agencies that beat the IRS on these counts, but I doubt it. The Gestapo, not a contender either. So here, so this IRS agent, and one of the things that he says here that how he really gets the taxpayers, he says, I want information. I bring out a little black book, and I say, may I have your name, sir? Which time he says they just fold, which reminds me of years ago, when I was a young attorney and I was a public defender, I represented a guy, he and his partner murdered a police officer, and I was the only thing between him and the gas chamber, and it was an interesting experience. But one day I asked him, how do you conduct a robbery? You know, these guys were real professional robbery. His face beams up, you know, almost like I'd ask a halfback how it feels to go across the goalpost for a touchdown. He says, well, he says, I have a 45. And he's smiling all the time, and he says, I pick it out, and I point it right at him, and I said, this is it. Then he says, I bring back and slam it forward, and he says, and a 45 bullet hits the table and rolls across the table and drops on the floor. And he says, I own them. Well, that kind of reminds me of what the IRS guy does. He says, can I have your name, sir? You know, this is about all. And he's got a little pen and a little black book. So you know, we are scared to death of those guys. Well, what was that earliest of all sayings? The man that fears the tax collector. So it is. So, well, let's see. Those are some of the examples of I think abusiveness of our system. Let's see what else I got over here you might like. Oh yeah, Ingmar Bergman. He was the great Swedish director. Made some wonderful movies. And the Swedish tax authorities got the feeling that maybe he was not paying his taxes. So the Swedish tax authorities went out while he's directing a movie and arrested him and threw him in the can. He hadn't done, you know, just arrested him. They also went out and picked up Bibi Andersson, a very beautiful Swedish actress that was on the set. They locked her up. They wouldn't even let her call home to her daughter. And just left, and they didn't, eventually they let her go, and eventually he was so upset that he left Sweden. And he went on to Switzerland, and then he went and put up with these guys. Well, finally they dropped any charges against him, and finally he came home, and the press in Sweden got wind of this and published it, and the government that had ruled Sweden for 30 years was thrown out of office the next time. So we're not the only ones that have to put up with these angry bastards. There's another thing that's quite interesting. If any of you get to Europe, in Rotterdam, there's a museum of taxation. It's quite a remarkable place. It's got all kinds of paraphernalia for smuggling, you know, not just empty bottom suitcases, but all the various devices, and it's really, really quite worth seeing. So we have that. The other thing we have is over in China. China is probably the only place today in which there are really riots and murders of tax agents. And one Chinese agency said in 2 years over 13 Chinese tax agents had been murdered. And then it tells a story in one province where the farmers, I wouldn't say arrested, the farmers seized four tax agents and shoved them in a pig pen and left them there for a couple of days.
This is an occurrence.
This is anyway. I thought it was pretty funny. And then of course, what about old Will Rogers? You know, everybody loved Will Rogers. You know, he was before our time, but he was probably the most beloved humorist in America. And he didn't like the tax system. And he said, when I pay my taxes on the level, I don't know if I'm a crook or a martyr. And then they went after old Will because he claimed a big deduction for his wife, and these are the days before he had joint returns, and all she did is open the mail. And his answer to that was, well, the income tax has made more liars out of the Americans than golf has. Now, those are golfers. But anyway, he's one of my favorites.
Wasn't he the one who said the difference between the taxidermist and the tax man was the taxidermist left the skin?
Okay, give me that again a little slower.
The difference between the taxidermist and the
oh, taxidermist. Oh, I see.
The
okay, yeah.
Leave the skin.
Yeah, yeah. And he did get in hot water with a service over his wife's deduction, because he made a lot of money, you know, a very successful guy, and apparently he paid her $20,000 and deducted it. Well, a lot of money going back in the 20s, you know. Here's a bundle. He was a little...
bit much for opening the mail.
All she did is open the mail, yeah.
She was a high-class secretary.
Yes.
I got a great picture of him in the book. I'll see you. I think the book is worth the price. Nixon's tax scandal. You know how he got in trouble? There was a provision of the tax code that gave him the right to deduct the cost of his papers or something like that. But it had been repealed. So his tax accountant, the tax lawyer, backdated the transfer, and it didn't work. He got caught. So it's, oh, well, of course, Nixon was anything but a, well, he's a politician. You know, he just got caught. That's the only difference between him and the others. Oh, it's an interesting thing. One of these guys noticed that in my chapter on the tax havens called Flight to the Havens, up there at the top, they go Flight to the Heavens. This is something that publishers do sometime. And in the first edition, it simply had the offshore world, but I don't know why they did that. And the Rolling Stones, you know, that's some of you guys might be familiar with them in the musical business. In 1971, they left England because of the tax system. This is the way they go. And here's what they said. In 1971, we were forced to make a decision, courtesy of the British government, live in England and not be able to afford another set of tar strings. Or move out, keep the band together, hence Exile on Main Street, which is one of the songs that they wrote at that time. We did talk about some of the people who fled. We did talk about Howard Hughes. Now, Howard Hughes, and I told you how he avoided all tax. He paid no tax because he used the foundation and he borrowed money from it, and he paid interest on the loans, and the interest he deducted against his income. Even a junior accountant got to figure that out. But it took a lot to transfer all the Hughes Tool Company stock over to the American Foundation. And today we have one of the certainly wonderful things that came of that. But he never had a bone in his body of charity. He's pretty, with all that wealth he had, he was not a very nice guy. But one of the things that he did, and this is just one of the stories I'll give you, you might enjoy listening to. When he tried to get Nixon to move the atomic testing from Nevada up to Alaska, and the government really voted its back, afraid of what the Russians would do, and he stuck to it. He decided that he would set up a slush fund. Now, slush funds were kind of common in this time. Big corporations were doing it. Gulf Oil had one in the Bahamas, I remember. He decided to set up a slush fund. So he got some clever tax guys who, he got one of his aides, and the aide, the name of John Meyer was his aide, and Meyer went out and bought up all kinds of gold mining claims. He then sold them. And how did he do that? He bought up the claim. Go ahead.
One of the names was B.B. Rebosa. That was
one of
the slush funds.
Yeah, one of the slush funds. Yeah, I was just thinking. What happened is that's right. This guy bought up the claims through foreign companies, turned around and sold them for millions down to the Hughes Tool Company. And they bought them for peanuts. The result was they had millions of dollars that was collected offshore in the offshore company. And because it was offshore, it was not subject to U.S. tax. So he builds up this large slush fund, and the main target was Richard Nixon, or the main beneficiary was to be Mr. Nixon. But unfortunately, the plan had a little problem. The guys who originally, the old mining prospectors in Nevada, who originally had the claims and sold the claims offshore for a modest amount, didn't have the money to pay their tax. So what had happened is that Howard Hughes' aides gave them the cash in suitcases so they could pay their tax, and that should be fine. Well, the problem is they didn't pay their tax. You know, they just, this is wonderful. Now, you know, we sold our claims, we got a barrel of dough, and now they gave us the money to pay our taxes, and we'll just pocket that too. Of course, the IRS caught that, and they went to these guys, and they said, well, what did you do with the money? And he says, we spent it. Oh, and why did you do this? Well, we did it because they wanted us to do it, and we were very happy to cooperate and be part of the arrangement. And the claims weren't worth anything, but they were suckers anyway. So, well, the service is just absolutely unlivid over this, and they proceeded to try and chase this down. They went overseas, they contacted the banks overseas and the professionals overseas and everybody handled the money, and ultimately they never got a dime out of the deal. But the thing is, because the government got into that, then of course Hughes backs off. He doesn't want us everything to do with a slush fund. Well, that meant the slush fund was up for grabs, which was the other side of the coin. So all the people that were dealing with it were grabbing onto the money, and this was in Nevada. I know a little bit about this because I was familiar with it, and it was a rather funny story, but in one sense, but it was rather interesting that the service was really concerned with getting Hughes. They really didn't care too much about the money and who got it and so forth, but they wanted to nail Howard Hughes on this. And they almost did, because when he was in Venezuela and they had an earthquake there, and so he was then going to fly to London. And if you know any of the history, he ended up in London for a while. But the plane had to stop in Miami to refuel, the jet did. And the service knew he was coming. So when the plane was parked and Hughes was in it, the IRS agents went out to get him, you know, to serve him with a summons and so forth. And then Hughes just said, call Chester Davis. And Chester Davis was his lawyer in New York. And so he called Chester Davis, and Chester Davis called the IRS's the Treasury people. And they then told the revenue agents in Miami to lay off. And so they laid off. And so then Hughes went on and never did enter the United States. But Jack Anderson had written that Hughes had a lot of tax problems. That's one of the reasons why he stayed out of the United States, and that's true. But the tax problems were the attempt to set up the slush fund. That was what the tax problem was. But none of this you'll read about. I know about it because I was familiar with what happened. So. Okay, we'll let Mr. Hughes rest in peace.
I live in Houston, and
you would know where Dr. Loomis was from.
So that battle, the Loomises and some others, it went on for another 8, 9, 10, 12 years before it was settled.
Well, I think there were over 65 lawsuits against Hughes. Everybody that could sued him because they knew he wouldn't show himself. And eventually the federal, I guess it's the judge in the probate, he just said, I want these cases settled, get them out of here, I don't want to, and he literally forced them to be settled. But the heirs whom Hughes had no use for it and never seen, that they came out pretty good. because there was a wonderful man. Loomis did a wonderful job of managing, much better than the Hughes people did. And he was the one who was his nephew, or I guess it was a nephew, wasn't he? And he's tall, like Howard Hughes was. Yeah, it looks a bit like him. Yeah. I have a client of mine who was married to one of the Loomis family and was in on that deal. So and they tried very hard, you see, to prove that Howard Hughes wanted to give this to the Medical Foundation, you know, his estate, what he had left, which was a substantial. But they couldn't find a will. They could only find that he had made express, you know, he had said he wanted to do that, but he had no will. So I don't care who you are. You, you, you.
In the battle over which state?
Texas? Yeah, Texas, Nevada, yeah. The thing is, he hadn't been in Texas for years, you know. Years we've been in Texas. He actually was in Nevada, as you know, and that's when he left Nevada secretly. And that was really his domicile. So Texas was hanging in there, you know. When there's money involved, governments, they're as greedy as everybody else. They can smell it. So he's an interesting character. There's a lot of books on him, too. Well, some of the things I say in learning from the past. Many of the great nations tax themselves to death. Good question. Conversely, many nations became great because of the right kind of taxation. Taxation which stimulated growth and enterprise. So taxes can be a very positive and a very negative force. I said, whatever is taxed must be surveyed. So if the tax system is all-encompassing, liberty must give way. And all-encompassing taxation vests enormous power in the hands of the Revenue Bureau, and in time overpowers not only the taxpayer but the other branches of government. Even kings and emperors have had to yield to the power of the tax bureau. These are just lessons of history that I thought. The Greeks produced the first civilization without despotism, and they achieved this by discovering that tyranny is the product of the wrong kind of taxation, of direct taxation. Now, we don't agree with the Greeks, but because we have direct taxation. But anyway, that's one of the great lessons of it. Here's an interesting love is when wars and other great emergencies demand great revenues, then all citizens should be taxed according to what they are worth by equitable principles, not odious arbitrariness. Well, I guess I'm gonna whet your appetite. Maybe you'll buy the book anyway. Well, I got a half an hour if you want it, and maybe you're tired of hearing me. Well, what would you like to talk about? Some more stories?
Expand a little bit on this person you said in Florida that has an alternate scheme about the money. Can you explain?
There's a fellow in Florida. His name is Holmes, and he has an operation called Just One Tax. And he has he got the idea actually from Hamilton, going back to his writings, that what should be taxed is the flow of money. And when it flows slow, then there's not so much tax. When it flows fast, then there's more tax. And if you just tax the flow of money, just a tiny tax.
At every exchange?
At every exchange. At every exchange.
One-tenth of 1% or something.
Yeah, yeah. And that it would produce as much revenue as our own system produces today. He's talked to Congress about it, but he never has been able to swing it. But I thought he had a wonderful idea because it could be automatic by computers. Nobody would file tax returns. You know, if that'll work, that would solve our problems in terms of an intrusiveness of our tax system. We get rid of all the, you know, all the horrors that we know about.
And that would encourage putting it in permanent fixtures like factories and railroads and so forth.
Well, it would be in the banking. It would be the flow of money.
That's right. Your tax. The money that was in the factory wouldn't flow, therefore there'd be no taxes.
It wouldn't flow? Why wouldn't it flow? Is it dead in the bank account?
What you build up, the solid buildings would not
Oh yeah, it wouldn't be a land tax. It would only be a money tax. But everybody, everything is money. You know, money's what make the world go around. And so in that sense, of course, you would miss land. But land is usually taxed on the state level. You know, that's what supports our schools and roads and things like that.
Sold, there would be a tax on the flow of the money used to buy it, though, right?
Yeah, anytime money moves, it'd be automatically a tax on it.
And like buying a house, it would stay there a long time, but it's later set up 15 years later.
On the flow, yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Like the sales tax or the consumption tax, you would be able to capture the underground economy that's escaping.
Sure.
Thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
All kinds
yeah. Be very effective. The only thing it wouldn't catch would be the cash economy in that sense, the cash, because there's no way you could test you could latch onto the cash. It would be through the banks. The money going through the banks would be automatically the basis of the tax if you dealt with cash. But the amount is so small, it is necessary.
But what about say you had a lot of cash, but when you deposited. Either deposited or withdrew
it
from a bank, you incur that fee.
Yeah.
So unless the gangster kept it all under the mattress.
Yeah, you wouldn't get the mattress people.
But somehow, it would have to flow through the system, either through a merchant, when you buy something.
It would flow through the banking system. Well, everybody uses the banking system. Pretty hard to operate, you know, on a cash deal. It didn't work too well.
Oh, and maybe you know, the $18 billion that's being sent to Mexico every year.
Yeah.
To prop up Fox, get a little bit of that too.
Sure. Yeah, all money movement. And anyway, I thought it was a genius idea, and I know the guy. I met him, and I feel he has an idea that really needs to be looked at. Curtis Holmes, and it's called Just One Tax. Probably can get it on the internet.
Just.com.
Yeah, Just One Tax, yes.
You say here in your epilogue, the first is the glaring fact that all good tax systems tend to go bad.
Yeah.
Well, that means they're all bad.
No, they tend to go bad.
Well, the good ones turn bad and the bad ones are bad.
Turn anyway. Worse, yeah.
Our problem is we want less taxes.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
There's nothing that the government does for us. This is Hans Hermann Hoppe's statement that couldn't be done better by other institutions other than the government.
True.
That's what we need to aim for. We just need to cut taxes off totally.
Okay. I'll argue with that.
Instead of making, listening to you now, you're trying to make taxes fair.
Yeah.
What you said is impossible because all good tax systems tend to go bad.
I said tend to go bad. I didn't say did, tend.
Tend.
Tend, not did, but tend.
Well, I took some classes in economics and tend meant it's going to happen. But we don't want a fair tax system. We want rid of it.
Well, you know. Yeah, you're a utopian dreamer. The point is that we are a tax-oriented society, and so we simply have to come up with the best we can, knowing that this is the way our democracy has decided that we're going to go. And if you want to avoid taxes, really, then you're going to have to leave.
Well, let me ask you,
yeah.
if you read the stuff 100 years ago,
yeah.
H.G. Wells,
sure.
people,
yeah, okay.
There was no question they understood we can manage a society.
Yeah.
There's nothing to it. We're
that's right.
coming and that's to be
yeah, and...
Well, we're now, maybe we've discovered that didn't work.
No, that's right.
If we can push harder to this, cut your taxes, don't worry about making them fair, just cut them.
Okay.
When do you say that in here? Maybe you say to cut them. Are you saying cut them or are you saying make them fair?
Both.
They must be cut anyhow.
Yeah.
And we must get other institutions to do the things that we're asking the government to do for us now.
We've got expenditure.
Well, I'd get rid of the E. You suggested the guillotine a little bit ago.
I'm cheating all the politicians, you know. Suggesting looking for alternatives to the guillotine.
Yeah, we're discussing alternatives to the guillotine.
Zero. He doesn't want to exist.
I tell you, there were no tears when the heads of those tax bombers flopped in the basket. You know, they always had a big basket at the end of the guillotine, and down they came, and the head flopped in the basket. I don't think anybody had any tears. They were so hated, and I think there's in my book there's a story of a guy named Mike Klein who was 50 years old, and he retired to Florida, and he didn't have anything to do, and he'd been an accountant, so he went down and got a job working for the IRS. And he said, my brother refused to have anything to do with me. He says, you've joined the enemy. I never talk to you again. So everybody disowned him, and he tells some interesting stories about the service down there. He says these guys boasted about how they got this guy and how they got this woman to cry. And he says, you know, I said I was going to take away her kids and so forth. And he says, I remember this one guy, he said he just didn't have any money. So the agent told him to have his wife go peddle herself. Nice guys. And then he writes that one guy came in and had a heart attack and died. And he says, we didn't know what to do with him because there's people out there in the front waiting to be seen. He says, so we covered him up with a blanket and wheeled him out into the alley. But I like the thing he says, my family disowned me. They said, you've joined the enemy. And you know, it's not a job I would want. You know, I think that most of the guys who work in the service are sometimes they're accountants and they want to get a few years experience and so forth, and then they want to get out of there. And I remember once I had a case, and there was this young guy there, and I ran into him on the street a year later. After this case was over, and he said, oh, I left there. He said, I was really glad to get out of that job. And he just didn't want anything to do with it. It's a, I guess, go ahead. Yeah.
It's kind of think of it, I doubt if any of us have any IRS agents as friends or acquaintances.
Yeah.
You got one.
Yeah, in fact, I had a family I had represented for many years, and the son who was managing the company died, and his wife, everybody was quite concerned about her. And then one day I get a call. Her name is Diane. They said, Diane has remarried. She's remarried an IRS agent. And listen, that family was really concerned and worried, you know, because, you know, they always, big families with big bucks do interesting things. And they were quite distressed with the fact. With the lad I heard, she had divorced him and now everything's okay. Yeah.
Now, as long as we're talking, this guy, I know I'm a train buff and go to National Historic Railroad Society meetings every year. And, most years, and this IRS guy is from New Jersey, and he's retired now, but he's told me some things, and after, you know, I quit paying the income tax, and when he found that out, he didn't want to talk to me anymore. He said I could call him, but he couldn't call me because my number would show up on his phone list, and he was afraid they'd tap in and get him. And he says they're bad about really getting after IRS employees, making sure that they really toe the line. And, back when the 1998 Restructuring and Reformation Act took place, if an IRS employee even mentioned illegal tax protester, they were automatically fired. And he said things got so strenuous in the office that his blood pressure shot up, and he changed jobs until he was maybe a couple of years later able to retire.
Well, that's good. I'm glad he changed jobs. Yeah.
He says now that if he'd had a choice, he'd have never got into it. He didn't really know what he was getting into.
Well, it's like that quotation from the magazine this morning that I read from the Nation, where he said, where they described tax agents as of the most odious of mankind. You know, and they really are. Maybe I should read to you. Let's see, it's in the book. Carl Hess. You remember that name at all? Carl Hess was a wonderful tax resister. And he and I were sort of friends, and he wrote a little quip in the back of my first book, and I had the worst time getting a copy of the book to him. I'd mail the book down, you know, just a courtesy, and he never got the books, because the IRS sees in everything that came into his he was a Goldwater speechwriter. And he made this, 81, I think this is it. He retired to West Virginia, and he proceeded to support himself by barter. He died some time ago. He was quite a remarkable guy. He wrote a book called Dear America. If you ever have a chance to pick up that book, it's one, you know, I'm not one that believes in reading of a great number of books, but I think it's important to read good ones. They'll stay with you. And Dear America was the book that he wrote. And this is where the quote comes from. I became a tax resister, not simply because of the Vietnam War, not simply because of corruption. I became a tax resister at that particular moment because I got mad. And because somewhere in everybody's life, their problem is a line in the real world which you will not or cannot pass, and which, often with a sort of sudden anger, I felt you balk at, stand on, and fight on. So he just said, I had enough, and that's it. You know, he wrote this wonderful book, Dear America, and he was a Goldwater speechwriter.
What was his name again?
Carl Hess. Let's see if I got it right. Let's see if I got his. K, Carl Hess. Yeah, he does have a few books out, and he had heart trouble, and he died about 10 years ago. But they made a movie, a documentary that won Academy Award on him back in 1970s, I guess. And that's worth seeing, you know. And it was, since it was Academy Award winner, but it was a documentary. Yeah, and it was on his life. You get a few of those courageous souls like him, and they're all right. He, I eventually got him a book by sending it down registered mail and return receipt and all that. And so they didn't steal that, but. As I understand it, he had this small little home up in the back hills of West Virginia where he lived, and he was still writing, you know, against the IRS and stuff like that. Well, I just like what I read, and apparently he says that one day two carloads of agents showed up. Two. And they seized everything in his house. He didn't have much, fairly humble, you know, just they were trying in some way to shut him up. But I don't think they succeeded. He was a one of those great souls that stands up against corruption, yeah.
You say that he left a remarkable collection to posterity of books and things. I wonder where those reside, his writings. I wonder where his papers are.
I don't know. Be interesting.
Find out if he had any heirs and see where they are.
I know he had a wife, and she lived on, but he a lot of libraries should have his stuff.
Yeah, the library here actually has most of his, a lot of his books.
Okay, well, that's good.
Papers and stuff.
Yeah. Do they have Dear America?
Oh, yes.
Well, wonderful. Yeah, wonderful. So they can read it. I had a really lot of trouble to get my copy back. I gave it to some guy to read, and then I asked for him to give it back, and he wouldn't. I sent him $5 for the mail. He still wouldn't send it back. Then he died, and then I contacted his wife, and I hammered on her for a while, and apparently she had donated the book to the library. So she went down to the library and got it de-donated, or whatever you call it, and I got my book back. It took me about 5 years to get it. So when you loan books, you never know. You know, that's the old story. My grandfather used to have a thing when somebody would come to borrow something, he'd say, "I'll lend you the dog." And people would look with a puzzled look on their face. He says, "Why the dog?" He would say, "Well, the dog will come home at night." Yes.
Talking about federal judges and the corruption or misjudging of cases. There's a fellow I know running for Congress, and he's in touch with a Reagan appointee and lives near D.C., and they've written up some bills in case he gets in Congress, and one of the bills he's going to introduce is the procedure according to the Constitution of ridding the federal inferior courts, in other words, everything below the Supreme Court, and doing what they can to judge the judges, and if they are using foreign case law and such as they appear to be, or just making the law up as they go, start having some hearings and dismissing federal judges.
Don't think they can.
Constitution allows it.
Does it? Yeah. I thought they served for good behavior.
Yeah, but
well, I guess that wouldn't be good behavior, huh?
Right. Using, if they go outside the Constitution. Violating the Constitution is not good behavior.
Well,
that's
no.
By the definition.
I don't think they'll do too well. That's impeach them. Yeah, go ahead.
Right. Tell me if the tension between the Fifth Amendment and our obligation to report on ourselves,
yeah,
our tax returns, has that been thoroughly hashed out in the courts to any kind of rational conclusion? I've seen tax protesters say, my Fifth Amendment gives me the right to not sign my tax return because it'll be used against me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was actually the case law in the case of United States versus Boyd back in around 1890. And the Boyd case was a wonderful case because they said that the judges said that they condemned the idea of being forced to report or provide information to the government that could be used against you. You have an absolute right not to do so. And it was a tax case, as a matter of fact. The problem with the Boyd case is they kept whittling away on it, and finally, Sandra Day, isn't that the Supreme Court Justice, the lady out from...
O'Connor.
Yeah. Yes, she wrote an opinion, and she said, the Boyd case is dead. And it is. So, and all those principles that you're raising there, which were supported by the Supreme Court, are dead. You don't have any of those rights. And what she's saying is because of the case that she was writing on, you know, the opinion she was writing, that the court has now just simply thrown out the Boyd case. You don't have any of those rights.
Or if you just refuse to sign a tax, fill it out properly and everything, send it in unsigned, they're going to do something.
Yeah, they can come after you. Yeah, yeah, it's too bad.
Of course, anyway, they would go after, like if I sent one unsigned, mm-hmm. then they would order the hell out of my prior years that I did sign.
Yeah, it's one of those things where if you give them a bad time, they can give you a bad time. And so you have to decide if it's worth it. That's a simple question. I've always taken the position with people is to try to be audit proof, have your tax return look clean, sneaky clean, don't give anything on that, a flag and audit, because you don't want an audit. And I just think that's good advice. Now, I go to accountants and say, well, always leave them something. You know, when you file your tax return, leave him something. So then the agent can find something, and then he'll get off your back and so forth. That's enough. But leaving something doesn't mean that your tax return is not clean. But I just think that good common sense, unless you're some kind of a martyr, well, Carl Hess was. I mean, you know, he bowed his back, and that was his position. But I think most of us are just chicken like I am.
I wouldn't think I'd be unregulated. My business is regulated by the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Yeah.
So there's a million things that you could be, get in trouble with them for. Mm-hmm. Things you don't even think about.
Yeah.
From audits from them. It was just a curiosity question.
Well, we're a highly regulated society, and it's too bad, yeah.
I was pleased to hear your comment on plea bargains.
Yeah.
Jacob Walker, who's a retired, very successful lawyer in mm-hmm. the county, ran a class for us, and he had a lawyer speak to us about plea bargains and
yeah.
how successful they were in the courts in Lee County.
Yeah.
And being a very prudent fellow, I just kept my mouth shut.
Yeah.
It sounded to me like, because I think the comment was that plea bargains are always accepted in Lee County.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody ever mm-hmm. argues. It's always settled and everybody's happy. It means some guy got it, I think.
Well, if you're guilty as hell, then it's not a bad deal.
Of course.
Yeah. But when plea bargaining is bad is when you have the threat of a prosecution that you're really innocent of. You know,
yeah.
and so they want to plea bargain you. Well, it's a solution. I guess it's like Martha Stewart. You know, they offered her a plea bargaining, and she turned it down.
No, I would have taken it.
Oh, sure, absolutely. But she was just thought she could beat him. But she obviously had lied through her teeth. And when you do that, you better make the best deal you can, because they had her cold. And then what was so interesting about the jurors, they were sitting there waiting for her to take the stand and waiting for them to introduce some evidence and offer something to get out. They never offered anything. I think one of the worst cases we ever had was O.J. Simpson, mm-hmm. because he didn't testify. But the reason he didn't testify is that they would have acquitted him if they'd had a movie camera of it, because he was one of their boys. And the argument was, it's out in Los Angeles, those on the jury, what would they tell their neighbors, you know, if they nailed him? But he was guilty as hell, and everybody knew it. So then they get the idea, well, gee, that's a good way to go. When you're in trouble, just don't take the stand, and then see if you can argue your way out of it. But that was a case, the O.J. case was one in which the big mistake was trying him in South Central Los Angeles when the crime was committed out in Brentwood. And if you tried him out there, it would not have had a really sympathetic jury. And he would never get out of that. I could never understand why the lady that did the prosecution got $6 million for her book. I mean, she's so bloody incompetent. Why in the world would you give her a nickel? Just in my opinion. I followed that case, and when I knew they were going to try it down in South Central Los Angeles, I said, case over. They'll never convict him. Apparently, there was a problem of where would you keep him. They didn't have adequate jail facilities out in the Superior Court where the crime was committed. So they keep him locked up, but not have to commute every day with O.J. that they said, we'll try it right there by the court, right where the jail is and so forth. So it was kind of a practical solution, but it was a stupid solution because, okay, so you drive him out there every day. At least you get a fair jury, and you don't get people who are prejudiced against the police and who are biased in his favor and would believe anything. So it's one of those sad cases. What really made me irritated when he was acquitted, one of the black colleges around here, was it Howard or something, all the kids yelled and screamed, you know, He was acquitted. Why would you want to yell and scream for a man that got off for murder? I don't understand that. It just shows you that the deep prejudice in our country between the races. And it's kind of sad that even college students, which you think would have a sense of justice and fairness, would have that sense rather than want to get some guy off.
Unfortunately, they're still stuck on the plantation.
Yeah.
Well, and the justice system isn't fair to them. I mean, if you look at the percentage of blacks who are in prison compared to the percentage of whites, and then in drug cases, there are far more whites who use drugs, and there's a far higher percentage of blacks who are in prison. It's not fair to them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, a disproportionately heavy number of death sentences they get for murders. Mm-hmm. Those statistics are very, very interesting. They're very telling, too.
Well, and we don't have that problem in Canada. Well, we're 3:30 and we're at Friday afternoon, and thank God it's Friday. And thank you. You've been a great group. I've really enjoyed it. I'm happy to have been here and happy to talk to you. It's been my pleasure, my honor.